I'll start it off there, Don, if you want.
Yeah, start it off.
Give me the thumbs up. Hey, we are on the line with Topher Gaylord with Under Armour, and we're wrapping up this year's Under Armour Mountain Running Series. It was a series that we've talked about for the last few months. Three great events, one at Mount Bachelor, Oregon in July, one at Killington, Vermont in August, and the wrap-up with one at Copper Mountain, Colorado just a few weeks ago in September. And we just wanted to get Topher's wrap-up of how things went. How did the first inaugural year of the Under Armour Mountain Running Series go, Topher?
Hey, and Topher, if I could just jump in, for those that can't see Topher at home, he is fully decked out in Under Armour gear. I mean, he's got the shoes, the shorts, the shirt, that even the wristbands back from the 70s, he dug those up from some box somewhere. He's ready to go. Topher, what do you got?
Are those Under Armour tattoos you got on there?
Right on, guys. Yeah, we're fired up. We are fired up about the inaugural year of the Ultra Under Armour Mountain Running Series. We had a really cool kickoff July 22nd in Mount Bachelor, and then we moved to a 2-day format in Killington, Vermont, August 18th to the 20th, and then we actually shifted gears and moved on to Copper in early September. And it was so cool. It was really cool about it. And, we're in the Cascade Volcanoes in Mount Bachelor, spectacular setting in July, close to Bend, Oregon, just a rocking environment. And what was really cool on all race series locations is we had seven different distances. So 5K, 10K, half marathon, a marathon relay, a marathon, and then a 50K with prize money for the top three men and women, with a $5,000 purse for the top three men and a $5,000 purse for the top three women. So really cool, really cool, and attracted some amazing talent. We had over 1,500 runners across the three locations, and just a really cool kind of confluence of urban kind of young urban runners and run crews combined, maybe running their first trail race ever, combined with some of the most elite trail runners in North America. So it was really a cool mashup of cultures and really, really fun.
Do you think that you accomplished what you were trying to do from the onset? What was the initial purpose or initial goal?
Yeah, I mean, for us, the real goal was to create an experience that would create memories for a lifetime for trail runners. I mean, I think now more than ever, people and trail runners and runners are looking for defining experiences, and it's so cool. And I really feel like we accomplished that in spades. I mean, we introduced a lot of runners who had never run on trails, and we put some savage courses together. It was cool. I mean, Killington, Vermont, that was probably the toughest of our three locations. You might scratch your head like, wait a second, the Appalachian Mountains only go to like, not much above 4,000 feet in many locations. And man, we had a 10K with nearly 3,000 feet of climbing. Oh. And we had a 50K with 10,000 feet of climbing.
Wow.
And it was tough. I mean, it was like UTMB preparation. It was really, really tough terrain, but it was a super sense of accomplishment for the runners and for some of these first time trail runners. It was a real, real sense of accomplishment for them. And then we created this really cool base camp atmosphere at the base of the mountains, with a really cool, like we had a really cool recovery zone. At Under Armour, we're really focused on an athlete's total experience. So both their training, their competing, their nutrition, and their recovery. And so we had some of our Under Armour training coaches. We've got some of the best coaches in the world that work with our biomechanists and our engineers, our footwear and our apparel, and they were there on site. So when runners would finish, we had a recovery zone to stretch out and then to actually take them through a series of recovery exercises and also test both their biomechanics and their overall fitness through a new online training application called Fusionetics. And it was just a really cool experience for runners to mingle with each other and share both the stories and kind of camaraderie of a really tough race, and then engage with the run community and kind of engage with the local community as well. We brought some of the local running stores, had stands there at the finish, and everyone actually got these really cool, you could make custom made t-shirts at the finish with the specific kind of branding of the event. So just a lot of really cool things that like pulled the community together. And of course, it always culminates with great food and great beer as well.
Hey, you know, Topher, I'm glad and really happy that you're introducing trail to road people. You know, they come over and quickly they become trail people. But I'll bet you had some shock and maybe horror when you run a 10K with 3,000 feet and you look at your average mile pace and you're like 17-minute miles and you're like, I worked very hard out there and I usually run an 8-minute mile on the road. What happened to me?
Yeah, we had guys that are like, you know, they're close to 30-minute 10K runners, and they finish the 10K, and they look down at their watch. It's like, wow, it took me 1 hour to run a 10K. Like, really? And I'm like, yeah, with 3,000 feet of climbing, that's what you get. And it's just really great. I think it's a great experience for, you know, people that traditionally run on the roads that, you know, are working hard, you know, all week long, and maybe they haven't had the opportunity to get out on the trails because a lot of trail races are, you know, half marathon, marathon, or a lot of 50K, 50 milers in longer distance races. And so, you know, we really wanted to create a format that kind of enabled people to just get acquainted with the trails without being intimidating. And that's where the 5 and 10K distances were really good. And we had a really cool vertical challenge, which ended at the top of each one of the mountains, incorporated and embedded into the race format. So really cool for people to kind of finish off. We did that at sunset, so people kind of get that golden hour of running when you get to the top and just, you know, check out just the beautiful scenery around you. It was really special.
Tell us a little bit about what your plans are for 2018. Are you going to continue the race series?
Yeah, so we were really energized by the participation this year, and in all fairness, we got a late start to kicking this series off. I think we kicked it off in March. And so, as we all know, runners are incredibly disciplined and focused on their goals and typically lock in their schedules quite early. So we were really happy with the turnout we had. We're in the process now of fine-tuning the locations and dates for next year, and we're hoping to publish those literally in the next month. And our plan next year is to, again, run, I think we're looking at adding one additional location next year. So we have Mount Bachelor, Killington, and Copper that we ran this year. We may switch up the timing of the dates just to be as least conflicting as possible with other events, both in the area and other big trail events, so we can ensure we're not splitting the trail community. But we're going to definitely look at those three locations again, and then we're going to plan on probably adding a fourth location within the resort network. Stay tuned, but it will definitely be those three plus one more.
That sounds great.
In 2018.
And you really can't have these race events without having product. Where are you guys going with some exciting new stuff?
Oh man, we got a lot of cool new product that we launched this year. super energized about our Horizon trail running shoes, specifically our RTT and our KTV styles, terrific trail running styles in our Horizon series. And they've just got a killer ride. I mean, they're super cushioned with a great kind of Michelin outsole, great traction, and a super agile fit. So they're kind of like trail running in a race car. I mean, they're really sporty and really agile. And we had a lot of people, we had a lot of demos at the trail running events that are just building a lot of enthusiasm around those shoes as well. And then we're really excited about the product we're bringing in 2018. We're launching several new styles with our new Hover cushioning platform, which is a super plush, cushy ride combined with a superb energy return for just a sweet ride for runners, and then just a really kind of obsessive detailing around the upper and the outsole to just give kind of that perfect fit and perfect ride. So really psyched about where the footwear is coming in the run category, and really psyched about giving people the opportunity to try it all out on the trails next year.
If someone's interested in learning more about this Horizon series, they can of course go to your website, underarmour.com. And if they want to, you know, buy a pair, what's the best way to get a hold of a pair of these new sports car trail running shoes?
Yeah, I think our website is what I would encourage folks to go and peruse and take a look there with regards to learning about the product. And then you can also discover on our website a local retailer that's nearby, you know, where you might live. And we always encourage you to go find that perfect shoe in your local retailer. But you can certainly start with our website to learn more about the Horizon Series shoes, and I would encourage you to use our website to find that closest retailer to you.
Hey, Topher, before we let you go, word on the trail is that one of your featured athletes, Cameron Haynes, is going to be out there at Moab 200 or 240 this year. Is any truth to that rumor?
There is 100% truth to that. Cam's the man. He is he's a man of endurance, and I don't know if you know a lot about Cam. He ran a 200 miler last year in the Cascades. And so this is the second, I guess, of his grand slam of 200 milers. And he's been preparing so hard for it. And, you know, he's such an inspiration for us because he's just such a hardcore, pure outdoorsman. And I think he's going to do just terrific out there. So are you guys going down there?
We're kind of waffling on that. I've got my name halfway in the hat for that one.
Hey, okay. Topher, I don't know if you know, but Don has, this is, he's already run three 200 milers. He's trying to do the Grand Slam this year. I think we're going to pressure him into it. He ran Bigfoot, Tahoe, and, if he runs, Moab, that'll be the three 200 milers. Although Moab is 240 miles. This year, in the last 2 months.
Don, I think you got to line up.
Well, I just need just one more feather to push me over the edge, so that might have been it. Hey, we appreciate...
That's it.
We appreciate Under Armour for all they're doing, for introducing the trail to the road people and the people that are just needing to get out there and enjoy it as much as we do. So, Topher, you're fantastic. Thanks.
Right on. Thanks, guys. And we'll look forward to catching up with you and seeing you out on the trails.
You got it. Take care.
All right.
Health IQ, that means it's time for another quiz, Scott, to make sure we are qualified as a low-risk pool for better rates with life insurance.
Life insurance is a good thing to have. And if you're in shape and taking good care of yourself, you should get lower rates than just the average random person out there. Today's quiz is fitness, working out with your dog. Are you ready for this, Freeman?
I'm ready.
Dog owners walk significantly more than non-dog owners.
True.
That's true.
Is it true?
That's true.
True and
no,
false?
It's not
okay,
true or false.
Good.
No.
Okay.
Dogs help increase daily activity by boosting what? Skin health?
No.
Motivation?
Yes.
Hand-eye coordination?
Negative.
Or gym attendance?
Well, I'm just going to say B. What was it? Just motivation.
Motivation. Dogs offer accountability and motivation to stay active. Dog owners are more likely to exercise at least 150 minutes a week and walk for leisure. That's amazing.
Yeah, a perfect training partner. Somebody that comes up and wags his tail and tugs on your shoelace to say, let's go.
Yep. Okay, second question. What type of exercise can be particularly beneficial for dogs and humans with arthritis or other joint problems?
Ooh.
Downhill walking?
Negative.
Agility training?
Negative.
Swimming?
Yes.
Or jogging?
Just swimming. I mean, that's easy on the joints, especially if you have some arthritis. No reason to shut down just because you have a little bit of arthritis.
Yep. Swimming can be a good alternative to running and walking for older dogs and those with joint pain. Make sure the dog is able to safely enter and exit the water.
Good. I'm two for two. Let's go for a
two
for
two,
Scott.
Last question. When playing fetch, it is important for both the dog and the owner to warm up. Humans should always throw gently at first to avoid what? Respiratory strain, losing the ball, rotator cuff injury, or hip displacement.
Yeah, I'm going for rotator cuff. That's the first thing that came out of my brain.
You nailed it. Throwing a ball requires warm-up and focus. Start with the short throws and let the dogs warm up too. Using the ball launcher can also reduce strain. So now we know how to keep your dog healthy. Go get a dog if you're having motivation to get out on the trail and get in shape.
The best life insurance you can have is, one, getting a dog, and two, go to Health IQ and check out their rates.
Go to healthiq.com/TRN.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast with me, a complete imposter here in London, England, and your two real hosts over there with a skeleton behind them very early morning in the studio. It's Scott and Dom.
All right, are we ready?
Yeah.
There's a bunch of like old brothel hookers like buried out here.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys have won a couple of awards. And
I've never prepped for a podcast ever.
Oh, that's what you're doing.
Okay, we'll clear that up. That will the group of the nation and podcast downloaders are very sophisticated.
They are.
They're unlike any other group out there. They're tolerant. They ignore our many imperfections, and they'll be able to substitute the word. No problem.
They will.
Are we ready? All right.
I'm ready.
We ready?
You ready?
Yeah.
Do you even know what we're talking about, Freeman?
Not really.
Okay.
So I'll enter.
That's usually the way we roll.
I'll get it started.
And you'll introduce a topic, and you don't even know what it is.
Yeah.
I love it.
Let's see how it goes. And then I'll say my name, Scott, and then Brad. You say your name, Brad Kearns, right?
In case you don't remember.
Of Primal Endurance.
Yeah.
Okay. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Scott War.
I'm Brad Kearns at the Trail Runner Nation headquarters in Rockland.
We hijacked
on loan from?
From Primal Endurance.
Primal Endurance podcast.
We heisted him, we kidnapped him, and we brought him with a burlap sack over his head, a piece of twine around the neck, back of the trunk, and straight to Studio G.
The Studio G is highly confidential.
it's like Borat. Agreement not necessary. Come to podcast.
It's three stories below the surface. And we have straight from London, Warren Pohl.
The Beatles.
He's dressed today with all kinds of hair on his head, barely recognizable.
We accused him earlier of taking some of his chia seeds and putting them on his head and watering them.
He looks very much like a chia pet. What do you have to say for yourself, Warren? What's up with this new look?
The business of entrepreneurialism and building a company, it's a busy time. I don't have time for frivolous things like haircuts. And so that's why I look like a hedge, or maybe it's just the fact that, you know, you kidnapped Brad Kearns quite recently.
Yes.
You kidnapped me that long ago. Look what happened to my hair. I haven't been out of this cupboard. Pete, you keep saying I'm in London. I'm actually in the back of Studio G behind that skeleton.
there, like a dumpster.
Yeah, there's an L on your door. That's closest we can get you to London. So today's topic is some nutrition, right? I believe
we're going to talk about stomach distress. How can you avoid stomach distress on a training run or during a race?
Ooh.
That is one thing that a lot of people deal with, including myself. And we're going to talk about some of the strategies that you can today take out on the next training run and try to cure it.
Hey, before we dive into that, Brad Kearns, you have been in endurance running, racing, triathlete, and performed at the highest level. I mean, you could find your image on the front of a magazine, Triathlete World or something that they call it. I don't know what it is because I don't read that.
We have one of those on one of the past podcasts.
And you've been on Wide World of Sports where they actually had you running and riding and swimming. How has nutrition changed over the last few years of decades from then to now?
Yeah, I mean, I started in the days before 33 Shake, which is so long ago. And it was really interesting because back in the mid-80s when I got into triathlon from, you know, coming from running background in college and not needing sports nutrition or any additional calories even during the longest runs,
yeah.
Then you get into this new world where you're heading out there for a 100-mile bike ride, and boy, you better pack some nutrition, otherwise you're going to be in trouble. And, you know, in some ways it might have been superior to the prevailing approach today when people are just shoving down these synthetic products into their system before, during, and after workouts, where they're hitting the recovery shakes or even the pre-workout Gatorade preparations that they're telling you to dose up with sugar before your workout and then slamming that sugar into your digestive tract, which is not well suited to digest anything when you're out there performing. And so we were relying on real foods for the most part. So in a lot of ways, we were so rudimentary, but maybe not that bad off. But my favorite answer to you kicked off the podcast with the topic, Scott. You said we're going to talk about nutrition, how to avoid stomach distress. And Scott Molina was asked that at a seminar. This is now 30 years ago. He was the man of epic one-liners and a man of very few words, but, you know, wise insights. One of the greatest triathletes of all time, known as the winningest triathlete of all time because of the number of victories that he had on the pro circuit, up to 175 or some crazy number because he raced all the time for years and years. And someone said, "How do I avoid, you know, stomach distress when I'm doing these long workouts and trying to absorb this fuel?" And he said, "Get in shape." And this was a large audience. Wow. You know, there's maybe 300 people watching this lecture, and everybody laughed nervously, like you just did, Don. Uh-huh. And chuckle. And then there was a pause in the theater, waiting for him to elaborate on the answer. And he's just standing up there, deadpan, like, "Next question." And that was it. He said, "Get in shape." And so, if we have a hierarchy, like a pyramid of, you know, what are the best fuels we're going to choose, and Warren's going to weigh in about why his preparation is superior to a synthetic sugar product. But I think number one at the very top is you got to get in shape and you got to be prepared for what you're doing. And I think a lot of people head out on those long runs, and or whatever they're doing. They're possibly in an overtrained state to begin with, or they're ill-prepared for the heat, the weather, the pace, if they're doing something like a competitive event, and they run into trouble, and the trouble comes in many forms, and one of them is that stomach distress as a component of whatever the reason is. Oh, I bloated out, and I overhydrated, I underhydrated, this happened, that happened, I vomited, I had the runs. Whatever the story is, the base cause is probably they were pushing themselves beyond their fitness capabilities, first and foremost. Then, second, are they going to choose something that's going to, you know, be nutritious, be easy to digest, and all that?
Hey, Scott, I know you have something to say. You could almost put cramping into that same discussion.
Absolutely.
Point, right? So you're talking about stomach distress, and if you just substituted the word cramping before you made that statement, it would fit too.
Scott, I'm not going to listen to this podcast because I want a quick fix.
Well, I mean, the show's over. Thank you for listening. If you're cramping, we'll do a whole show on cramping, and it can be, if you're cramping, get your ass in shape, and you probably won't cramp anymore.
You know, that makes a lot of sense now that I think back of all my cramping issues. hey, the reason why we decided to take this topic is, you know, it's been a while since we've had Warren on the podcast, and he shot us, as he always does, a good long list of topics. And this was an article, you know, 33 Shake is not only a great product, but they're also putting out a lot of good content on the 33shake.com website. And
Yeah, that's right. I remember we did a podcast, Warren, like a year ago, and I hit that website, and you just get locked in there, man. There's a lot of good content.
There's a lot of information. And this came from an article that Warren wrote, did a lot of research, as you know, or as you may not know. Warren is an investigative journalist.
All right, he's the real deal.
So he knows how to dig in and find the right information. And he wrote an article called, what was it called? 6 Steps to Avoid Stomach Trouble on the Run.
Is Warren with us? Has he spoke yet?
Hey, Warren, how's it going? Do we have connection?
No, I'm just here hiding behind the hair. I'm in the cupboard behind you in Studio G. Let me out.
Take the gag off.
Help, anyone can hear me. They've had me prisoner in here for weeks.
So let's talk about that article. And let's, Scott, you want to kick that off?
I want to know, why did you write the article, Warren? Have you had stomach distress issues? And talk about that.
So I think, as Brad suggested, and as any quick search of Google will suggest, stomach trouble when running is so common, whatever form it may take, whether that's dashing off into the bushes for an urgent comfort break in the middle of the race, whether it's making a mad dash to the porta potties on the way, whether it's the fact your stomach just feels terrible, whether you're not able to take on nutrition, whether you've got stomach cramp. There are so many forms that it takes, but it is so prevalent. And as 33 Shake comes about, when Erica, my wife, and another partner of ours, and we started looking at all these problems, because I was having so much trouble with my nutrition as I got into ultra running seriously around about 2007, 2008, and I just could not get rid of them. And with the investigative journalist hat on, I started looking at, well, you know, if all of the nutritionists out there who I was being exposed to as a journalist, if they were saying for these companies, you know, you need to train your stomach and you need to eat more product, I kept getting the same line. I kept following the same advice and I kept having the same trouble. I got stomach trouble. I've got erratic energy levels. I got poor immune function. I'm not recovering well from my sessions. I looked at what's in those products, and so many of them, I mean, forget the fact they're virtually all the same, regardless of the price point that you're paying. They're all based on the same ingredients, and these are ingredients that are toxic to the body and that have a number of short-term performance issues and long-term health problems that they can cause. So unpicking that, at the root of it all, the first place that many people encounter that their nutrition could be better is when they experience the same problems that we've all been talking about today, stomach trouble on the run, whatever form it may take. And so it's quite easy, having been now involved both in the running for a long time, but particularly for the nutrition so very heavily since we started the company in 2012, it's easy for me to think about the latest stuff that I'm now learning about and the new things. And, you know, for example, Brad's got a new book coming out with ketones, all about ketones, and sort of bringing together the latest thoughts on that. It's easy to stay on that sort of leading edge, but you've got to remember, where is everyone else coming to this? Where's the root? And this stomach trouble, it hasn't gone away yet. And it's something that I really wanted to give people some clear, actionable information. And regardless of what products they're using, this was about, you know, have a look at this. And what we try and do with everything on the blog, give people things that will allow them to get back in control of their own performance, get back in control of their own nutrition, and make choices that are not just going to make them faster today, they're going to make them healthier in the long run. Because there's not a disconnect between performance and health. Unless you've got the strong foundation of health, both now and going forwards, you can't build performance. So we try and give the information that lets people do both of those on the blog.
Let's talk about the stomach, how important it is, because if you lose your stomach during an event, you lose just about anything to keep you out there. That's your fuel source. That's what brings you in that additional energy that you need. We can survive out there till we hit the wall. You know, that's the point. We need some additional nutrition as we go. And if you get that gut bomb and you lose that stomach, you can't put new fuel in to keep you going. You can't expect to run a 50K or a 50-mile race without a functioning stomach, without functioning feet, without functioning, you know, you've got to take care of that very important organ.
Well, and I want to go back to a podcast that actually Brad was here with Zach Bitter, talking about becoming a fat-adapted athlete. even the best fat adapted athletes, you know, Zach Bitter being the poster child of that, still needs to take in some food during these runs.
He said the word trickle. Right? I love
and
that.
So the stomach is absolutely critically important, even if you are Zach Bitter.
Right.
You know, if his stomach turned south, he still would be compromising his performance.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
Well, his stories from his blog are really relevant because he's showing the performance advantage that he's gained by requiring fewer calories to sustain his competitive pace and get to the finish line, even running at a phenomenal speed, doing that 100-mile track record where he was running sub-7s or something right. for 12 hours in a row. It's just mind-blowing. Yeah. I mean, you go out there and the average ultra runner, how long can you hang with them? And it's going to be 2 to 4 laps in most cases, maybe 8 laps if you're really fit. And he's running all day long. And so the amount of calories, taking that down to, I think in the story, he was running 125 extra calories per hour. That's all he put in for performing at that level. And the slower you go, the fewer calories you're going to need because you're burning greater percentage of fat and less glucose, unlike an elite who's pushing that envelope. So if you can become fat adapted, whoever you are, you're going to require fewer calories. Therefore, your margin of error or your risk of stomach distress is going to be much less. And I mean, back in the triathlon days, we were told, and a lot of the elites thought, that 400 calories was the magic number per hour that would help you sustain your pace through, let's say, an Ironman or a half Ironman race. That's a lot of crap to put down. That's 4 gels per hour times 6 hours. That's some crazy stuff to even ponder. How are you going to accomplish that goal? So if you can get that thing down to 126 or something like that because you've worked so hard to become fat adapted through dietary patterns as well as proper training, then the whole picture is so much smaller because you're not having to throw down massive calories.
And I think that, you know, nutrition has evolved, absolutely. I was having a conversation with some other trail runners just this last week via some social media, and they were talking about carb loading. And I thought, I haven't heard carb loading for probably 3 years. But there's still this idea that you need to be carb loading and then taking a gel every 20 minutes, you know, these highly sugared gels. And then they were talking about stomach distress in the same conversation. And I think that this is a great conversation to have right now to reinforce some of the other podcasts and other discussions we've had about becoming fat adapted, being able to take in fewer calories, but then making sure that you're taking in the right calories, right, during a run. You know, Don just completed a very long 206.5-mile run.
It wasn't long for some. It was for me.
It was for me, too. I mean, I guess if you're, you know, on vacation, it couldn't be that long. But it was a pretty long race, and I was really impressed with his fueling strategy. He's a pretty fat-adapted. Would you say you're pretty fat-adapted right
now? I think I had
right
to
now?
Be out there. You know, I wasn't walking around with a buffet table, so I had to rely on my own personal fuel.
Your fat stores. Yeah. But then you were also being very strategic about the timing of fuel and the type of fuel you put in.
You were speaking about, Brad, the stomach digesting 400 calories, and weigh on this in on this too, Warren. That blood needs to go somewhere. You know, the blood That's needs to be cooling your body. You think about all the tasks that it's being asked to do. It needs to go to your lungs to pick up fresh oxygen and get rid of some carbon dioxide. It needs to go to the muscle to deliver fuel and pick up waste products. It's busy. It doesn't need to go to the stomach, too.
It needs to go to the
too.
Brain so you can figure out if you've gone 10K or 5K, right?
Or figure out a reason to bounce out of this thing. And that's what the blood's doing. And then to ask it to go to the stomach, I mean, there's the gut bomb. Pretty soon, that stomach is low priority. Then you get all this goo and stuff just washing around in there. No wonder it's going to get upset. And you just keep slamming them down. There's going to be a problem down the road. Have you experienced any of that, Warren? Any stomach distress?
Absolutely, and I think, you know, we could go down so many avenues on this and do no doubt an encyclopedic series, but just to pick up on a couple of things, just the the idea behind the carb loading and the taker gel before you start and take one every 15 minutes, you know, those recommendations come from companies who make their money selling you very cheap processed carbs at a high markup. They're going to recommend you use more of them. And the more that you use, particularly if you're taking them before the race, you are pretty much switching off your natural ability to burn fat before you've started, which is completely then, you know, it plays into the hand of a company that sells that stuff, but you are now stuck on the treadmill because you're not going to be able to access your stored fat properly. You're now going to be chowing down a load of stuff whether you wanted it or not. And then we come to that idea of a fixed number of calories. We come to that idea of a magic number and a schedule. And I get it, because there's so much to think about in running. You know, there's your training, there's your rehab, there's your prehab, there's pace, there's sessions, there's A races, B races. We've got so much going on. Between that, you've got to make sure you look good. So, you know, do your shoes match your socks? What pack are you going to have? What color is it? Does it match your eyes? There's a lot going on. And when it comes to, that's why mine's growing. I just don't have time to think about it anymore because I'm still trying to get that pack shoe combo and it's killing me. But, you know, I think I'm getting closer. But so when it comes to nutrition, you're like, I just want a formula, right? Give me the formula and I'll do it. And the problem is we're all different every day. Like, forget training, forget running. Do you eat the exact same thing for breakfast and lunch and dinner? Do you eat the exact same number of calories every day? Do you eat them at the same time? Do you eat them, you know, throughout the year, regardless of whether it's hot or cold or your time? And when it comes to successful in-race fueling, you need a framework to work off of, but you need to be able to respond to what your body's telling you. And the more you can tune into that, which is not actually that difficult once you begin to work at it, you can then eat and hydrate in relation to the signals your body's giving you, which means sometimes you could quite literally go, and I'm sure you know all of you guys would experience this, you could go 2, 3, 4 hours, eat nothing. And in the same race, you could go 1 hour and be eating every 10 minutes. It wouldn't matter, because as long as you're doing it in tune with the signals your body's sending out, you're never going to either get behind having not taken enough on, and you're never going to get too far ahead in terms of overloading your stomach. It's a skill that needs to be developed the same way you learn, you know, as you run more, you learn to avoid that injury when it crops up. You don't run through it anymore. You know, you get to learn those signals, and nutrition is another part of that needs to be evolved and developed. And that way, you're never going to suffer any stomach trouble again. And that's something we can go down. You know, I've got some basic tips on doing that. But, you know, what do you guys make of all that before we dive down another alley there?
Well, here's one thing we have to acknowledge when we go back to you're talking about the evil sports nutrition companies peddling sugar to the vulnerable clientele. And this is a literal truth that if you're eating in that standard American diet, high carbohydrate pattern and training in a chronic manner, which is a large portion of endurance athletes are doing, you are creating a dependency upon dietary carbohydrates, both during the day and during your workday at your cubicle in the afternoon. You need constant snacking and regularly timed meals that are high in carbs to sustain your energy because you suck at fat burning due primarily to your diet and also exacerbated by your adverse training practices where you're training at too high of a heart rate, burning more glucose than fat, and basically ignoring and shutting off your fat burning like Warren mentioned. So if you're in this carbohydrate dependency state and you want to go run 13 miles or 200 or whatever it is, you're going to need a crap load of carbohydrates both the night before in your carbo loading, and you're going to need 400 calories an hour like we were taught. Mm-hmm. And this stuff is validated by leading high-thinking scientists at the Gatorade Sports Science Institute, and they're going to work, and they're working hard, and they're devoted, and they're looking at the data and the research, and they're showing this is the reality. If you don't believe me, go out and try to run 13 miles on no calories, and if you're not fat-adapted, if you're a high-carbohydrate eating person, you're not going to make it. You're going to either be pushing for Uber, or you're going to go to the gas station. Yeah. And we went to the gas stations during these 100-mile rides, and at mile 80, we would go in there and get Skittles, root beer, and Hostess pie and slam that stuff down, and we could go from 80 to 120 on this rocket fuel and feel great. We were in shape, too, but the thing is, we were eating carbohydrate dependency diets. That was the paradigm that existed. Dr. Timothy Noakes is a great champion of the importance of transitioning out of that paradigm, because if you're stuck in the bubble, you're stuck in the paradigm. All these statements are validated. You do need those gels whenever your watch beeps every 15 minutes, or you're going to fall apart and bonk, and that's no fun. So first we have to take a step back and look at this big picture, and the first thing is making that decision to modify your diet, to ditch those grains and sugars in normal everyday life, and start working toward that goal of ditching carbohydrate dependency and becoming fat adapted. And part of that for the athletic person, for the ultra runner, is that you can leverage your fitness to accelerate your progress to escape carb dependency and become fat adapted. First thing you try to do, wake up in the morning, don't eat breakfast till you're hungry, maybe put in a 4-mile run in a fasted state, and then wait an hour afterward till eating, eat a high-fat, nutritious breakfast rather than your oatmeal, orange juice, toast, and berries, and you start taking baby steps in that direction. And this is, you know, the stuff that Zach's talked about so nicely and spread the word to all the athletes and so many other fat-adapted people that are performing, Peter Attia and Sami Inkinen, you know, with detailed experiments available on their websites that show the transition away from that carb dependency and the massive improvement in performance just from changing their diet, all other things being equal, you're able to go for a long time without bonking thanks to your dietary patterns as well as sensible training.
How long does it take to get out of that bubble? And this is to Brad and to Warren both. What do you guys, what has your experience been personally and coaching and watching others? Does it take a week? Does it take a year?
I think it was 24 to 36 hours with my secret method.
Ah.
No. Yeah, good
now
question.
Now we're talking quick fixes. Now I'm going to listen
there
to the podcast
go.
Again.
This show is brought to you by Quick Fix Kearns with his special strategy. That's an excellent question, and this is something that the individual can track themselves and see what happens. And so like in the Keto Reset Diet, the new book where we're talking about the ultimate expression of fat adaptation, going for that ketogenic benefits, ketogenic eating strategy, your first benchmark is you wake up in the morning and you assess how long you can function well without experiencing true sensations of hunger. And when you do, you go and eat. You don't suffer and struggle and force yourself to fast because you're doing some stupid-ass diet that you're not prepared for, but you track and notice how fat-adapted am I. And if you wake up right now at 7:15 and you're looking for calories before your morning run so that you can get the energy to head out the door, you're in a state of carbohydrate dependency, obviously. And you can aspire to, you know, grow out of that by eating these primal aligned meals with the approved products. And especially first step for everyone is ditching those refined carbohydrates, which have no nutritional value and are extremely destructive to the endurance athlete in particular, the people who eat most of them more than the average person, but they compromise your recovery, they create systemic inflammation, they suppress immune function, they get you sick, injured, swollen. I just read an article about Jeff Browning, who's been on the show, mm-hmm. and his transition to fat adaptation, where he says, my ankles and my legs are no longer swollen. And after races, I can get up and walk around. I don't need help getting out of my car thanks to my dietary transition. Nothing else different with this training.
And, you know, I'm gonna throw in here, my personal experience where I used to wake up for an early morning run and I would go grab some bread and some peanut butter and jelly and make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and eat that on the way to the trail. And I thought, there is no way that I can go out for an 8-mile run without having a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And as I started experimenting with this, per Brad's methodology of going out and running in a fasted state, the first few, I mean, Don, you can probably attest to this, the first few of those runs were tough, really tough. But your body adapts, and now that is the norm for me. I don't eat before I go on my morning run, and I don't actually get hungry on my morning run. When I'm done, I'm hungry, mm-hmm. and that's when I come back and have that good fat, high fat protein omelet that you're talking about.
Warren, how about you? How long did it take you to go from carbohydrate dependent, like a guy sitting on the corner on a park bench in the middle of the afternoon with his hand out? I don't know what I'm saying. Like a
like a homeless person looking for some handout.
He looks like a homeless person.
Well, that's all I can think of with the hair. But how long did it take you to become less carbohydrate dependent?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm very fortunate that Studio G and their charity Shelter have taken me in and got me off the bench. But the carbohydrate dependency, I was that guy who couldn't run to the end of the street without a gel in every product in every pocket, even though I didn't like taking them. They didn't make me feel good, but I was stuck in this loop. I would say to actually begin to feel tangible benefit and real difference, probably a couple of months. So on the one hand, you got the quick fix that Brad's talking about, where you are putting yourself on the path and you know that's going to have results. Now, for the to really see where those results start coming through, I'm going to say it's 1 to 2 months for me, where I began to realize I could go much further without food, and I didn't need to be taking in the same carbohydrate thing. And I think my biggest motive is probably the one we touched on most here, which is performance. You are the holy grail for any distance aerobic athlete is a stable energy platform to work from. You don't want spikes and troughs. You want a stable platform, okay? And that's what I wanted, because I felt I could do much better as a runner if I had that, but I didn't. Now, there's then a side effect. Your mental state is going to track your energy state. If you're constantly knocking in the carbs, then you're going energy spike, energy trough. And your mental state is going to track that. So there's another problem. Then we've also got the problem that you're putting in so much processed junk. That's when your stomach is already stressed. Your stomach is already low on blood. As we discussed, the blood goes to the rest of the body. You've got all sorts of things there, and you ask it to eat this stuff that just is not even food. I mean, some of those ingredients, maltodextrin is one of the main ones as one thing. It's nutrient negative. It will take more nutrients out of your body than it will put in. So at every turn, like when you want the most, these products give you the least. I wanted to get away from them. The whole thing of becoming fat adapted for me was performance related. But the longer I've been working on this, studying on it, and learning about it, I mean, it's a huge, huge health benefit for the future. I mean, if you look at running, if you can run strong today, then, you know, that's a great, you want to be able to run strong in the future. You're going to have a better quality of life for longer and longer. It's not about how long you live. It's about how good you live. And running is a great way to do that. And it's the same with this dietary change. You're not just getting a performance benefit today. You're getting a health benefit tomorrow. And putting all of those things together, it is just so powerful. So that was probably, you know, the performance motivation got me through that first couple of months, but I was so ready for it. And the number of nutritionists who worked for these companies who I'd spoken to, I can't count quite literally how many I spoke to as a journalist saying, okay, and you know, I'm doing endurance and I'm doing ultramarathons and what should I do? Not one of them once mentioned fat burning. I had to go up Mount Kilimanjaro with a Paralympic cyclist to discover what fat burning was. And when I ran down off that mountain as quick as I could, I came home and I bought Stu Mittelman's book, Slow Burn. And suddenly, I was like, okay, there's this thing called fat burning. That's what I've been looking for 2 years. So I was pretty motivated to get through it.
I have a question of timing. You know, you mentioned yourself becoming more fat adapted. Did that come first, and then the idea that you needed some kind of a natural food gel or 33 shake is what I'm saying. Did that come after you became fat adapted, or did that come before thinking there's got to be something better than these sugary gels? Let's invent that and then become fat adapted.
Is that chicken and egg question there?
Chicken and egg.
Okay, chicken or egg.
Water. Both very high protein, good fats. Right?
So I've come down off Mount Kilimanjaro and I've discovered the holy grail of fat burning, and I've read Stu Mittelman's book, and I'm finally seeing a way out of the weeds that I'm stuck in with all these products that I hate that give me trouble. And so that's the point where I realized, well, hang on a minute, none of these products are going to help with me being efficient or being able to access my stored fat. So I can't use those, so I start looking for alternatives. So the desire to become more fat adapted leads me to look for alternative products. And when I discovered that I couldn't find any. That's when my wife, Erica, and I, she's a triathlete, we began looking for those alternatives and going, well, if you then look at nutrition a little more deeply, and even this is very, very basic, like, what's the healthy thing to eat? Is it going to be the giant bowl of M&Ms or without peanuts even? Okay, we're not even going to go to peanut M&Ms, just giant bowl of M&Ms. Or is it going to be the like fruit salad and all of that good stuff there, fresh whole food? And we know, like, as athletes, you don't eat junk food. You eat good food for your performance. Yet on race day, you're eating junk food. So it's crossing that bridge as well, because why on the day we want the most should we give our bodies the least? And that's really where 33 Shakes starts to come around. And we're like, well, hey, there is nothing that does this. So we started to look at what are the most powerful natural ingredients we can find and how can we best create, combine, and deliver them so that athletes can use them the way they need to. And that's really where the company begins. In the kitchen, just behind me here.
You know, you're right. Our aid stations are filled with what looks to be a junk food, you know, a buffet. There's Oreo cookies, chips, and just junk.
There's people calling for In-N-Out at Western States, mile 64 in Forest Hill, right? And they call for In-N-Out from the town. Like, that's the thing they're dreaming of for running through the canyons into the night. And it's just mind-boggling to me. I've had some arguments with the great Julie Fingar, one of the great ultra runners, but I'm like, how can you put that shit in your body when you're doing an athletic event that is so torturous to begin with, and then you're throwing down French fries with refined high polyunsaturated oils that are causing an immediate oxidative disturbance to your cardiovascular system? But it's sort of tradition, and it's that psychological component where you know you're going to make, if you make it to Forest Hill, you get the slathered animal-style burger. But I feel like these issues come into play because you're not fully fat adapted and you're hungry, and all these sensations, the hunger hormone ghrelin is spiking because you're used to those regular doses of carbohydrate. And to be able to get to that point over the bell curve or beyond the curtain of Oz, where you're no longer dependent on carbohydrate, not only during the routine day, but also during an extreme ultra-distance event where you're running on fat and ketones, and that represents, and it's really looking like this is representing the future of elite performance and thereby the future of recreational performance too, is that these endurance athletes, more than any other athletes, because of that, not many people are worried about running out of glycogen during an NFL game or even an NBA game, but these people are most primed to benefit tremendously from being, you know, highly fat and keto adapted, to where the event is just, you know, pushing the pace and not worrying about your fueling.
You know, I'm going to go down a little bit of a detour, and I'm not going to take a whole lot of time, but I just listened to a podcast by Malcolm Gladwell, one of my favorites, called Revisionist History, and he talked about French fries, McDonald's French fries. When they originally introduced, They were fried in beef tallow.
Right, animal fat, a saturated fat, a temperature stable saturated fat that can handle that deep frying without, you know, causing that oxidative damage that a polyunsaturated oil is. But for whatever profit reasons and all that, they changed, right?
Well, they were forced to go away from that. They were bullied into going away from the beef tallow, and interestingly enough, and then we'll get back on track here, but I thought it was just brilliantly brought up. The beef tallow would fry the fry and allow it to, the inside of the fry is mostly water, and it would let the water escape, and that would keep the oil from going inside the fry. So the outside of the fry was very little oil in it. The new fries, actually, the oil goes into the fry, so you're consuming more of that bad oil. So anyway, I will link that on the show notes, because we know everybody reads the show notes since we did a
podcast. That's the only reason anyone's involved in the podcast.
Yeah,
the
podcast is rubbish.
I get them in advance.
The podcast supports the show notes. It's the only reason it's there. Hey, so back to Jeff Browning, and you said he's able to run without the same inflammatory distress on his joints. And that's what I heard you say, or at least that's what I'm trying to lead us to. Not only nutrition choices lead to gut bombs, but also joint bombs, where your knees hurt, your feet hurt, your hips or your back. Can you speak to that, either one of you?
Well, when you're burning glucose as your primary fuel, it is known as a dirty burning fuel source. It's cheap and dirty fuel. It's like putting in the low octane gas versus the nitrous stuff from the Fast and Furious cars, or the highest octane gas, and that would be fat, and even more so the internal production of ketones, the elegant creation in the liver of an energy-rich byproduct of fat metabolism when dietary carbohydrate is low. And so these fuels burn much more cleanly because they use mitochondria, which is the energy-producing power plants that are located in each cell. And so when you activate the mitochondria to burn calories, you're getting less reactive oxygen species or free radicals produced in the process of burning energy. So you're a cleaner burning fuel source. It's especially important for the brain and guarding against the cognitive decline and the diseases that are so prevalent today, which are now being largely attributed and linked to a high sugar, high carbohydrate diet. So in the athlete, especially when you're burning that volume of calories, you're burning so much more calories than the average person at rest. You're going out there and you're burning 10 metabolic equivalent of TAS, 15 metabolic equivalent of TAS. That's a measurement of how much harder you're working than you are at rest when you're doing a long distance workout. And so when you're burning mostly sugar, you're creating a lot of free radicals in the process, and that results in sustained inflammation even after the workout and the recovery period of whatever, 24 to 48 hours. And you notice this by waking up with stiff joints and just that general sense that you're inflamed and not feeling great when you get out of bed, and you need your coffee, or you need to go, walk around and get loose. And ideally, if you're eating a nutritious diet, you would wake up and feel refreshed and energized getting out of bed, because you don't have this oxidative stress going on all the time from your dirty burning fuel. And the reason that glucose is dirtier burning than fat or ketones is because it does not require mitochondria to process. It burns quick and easily. We have the campfire analogy where you think about a crappy campfire. You're tired. You're at the campsite. You're lazy. You don't know how to build fires. So you get a bunch of twigs, and you have a stack of newspaper, and you throw the wadded up newspapers, and you light this fire, and it takes 4 minutes, and it's building a big giant flame, and everybody's getting warm for a second. But then you got to keep finding more twigs and throwing more newspaper on throughout the night, or the thing's going to flame out. And the analogy is you got to keep snacking all day long, or you're going to crash and burn at your cubicle and not be able to function because you haven't had that energy bar in an hour and 42 minutes. That's the dirty burning campfire. And if you become fat and keto adapted, what you have is these big, nice, warm logs that once you get them warmed up and burning, they will keep you warm all night. You don't have to tend to it too much. It's just a beautiful campfire. There's not a lot of black smoke in the air because that's how the big logs burn, and you just kind of, get that kindling in there to get the fire going. You be patient. It takes a while to build that clean burning campfire, just like we're talking about what's the transition period to become fat adapted. If it's the first 21 days where you're making a sincere commitment to ditch grains and sugars and have a zero tolerance policy in your diet for any refined carbohydrates, then you're going to kind of graduate into the next transition where you feel like you don't need that peanut butter and jelly sandwich before you go for your run. You're burning fuel more cleanly, and everybody's got a chance. Like every morning when we wake up, we haven't eaten for 8 to 10 hours, so we're in a heightened fat burning state, possibly even making some ketones to burn instead of glucose. And we ruin it as soon as we ingest that first dose of high carbohydrate meals. So if you can just try to work your fat adapted abilities first thing in the morning by not eating a large high carbohydrate breakfast, you're going to be on your way to success. And again, because you're fit runner endurance, you have that ability to go out there and burn fat, you're going to accelerate your progress so much more than the average person.
Now, we've beat up on carbohydrates quite a bit in this podcast. Warren, you have some carbohydrates in your 33 shake product. How did you decide what to put in and how much to put in? And did you measure, monitor, and think about that?
Yeah, we definitely did, because clearly the processed, highly refined synthetic carbohydrates in huge amounts, that's a problem. And let's just put one thing in there. It's not just sugar. In the UK here, we have a thing coming in. It's likely the government is going to put a tax on sugars in soft drinks. Wow. Which seems like a pretty good idea. It seems like a good idea, right? And what do you know? all of these soft drinks from the major manufacturers are coming out, and we have reduced our sugar. Like, that's great. I wonder what they put in it. Oh, look, it's much worse. So the sugar's gone. It's replaced with things like aspartame, maltodextrin, acesulfame K, sucralose. These ingredients are toxic on an even higher level than sugar. So it's not just sugar. We got to look at the quality of what's in there. You've got to look at the amount. So when it came to what we were doing with our products, in terms of the in-race fueling product, which is the chia energy gel that we make, we based it on chia seeds, okay, because there you've got a really nice source of good fats, good protein, and because we keep the chia seed whole and it absorbs the water, that's also going to help regulate your hydration a little bit. And then there's a bit of Himalayan pink salt in there, which gives you a little bit of electrolyte. There's a bit of organic vanilla, which also is a good anti-inflammatory. So you're getting a very strong, instead of a gel made of maltodextrin, fructose, and water, which is going to be nutrient negative, absolute empty calories and that dirty burning fuel. We wanted to get it burning clean. But you need some carbohydrate. And even though there is a little bit in chia seeds, we use coconut palm sugar as the sort of cleanest and sort of most nutritious sugar we could find in a small amount. And that is exactly what you were mentioning earlier. That's the carb trickling. So there is some carbohydrate coming in straight away, but it's almost like, that's a ramp leading you up to a plateau. And so instead of spike trough, you've got a gentle ramp up, a long steady plateau of energy, and a gentle roll off the other side. That's really what that little bit of carbohydrates in there for. And then when we came to the pre and post product, that's all about maximizing nutrient density to absolutely take out all the stress the body's been through, to bring down the inflammation, to increase your immune function so it doesn't get knocked out when you're training hard and racing hard. That's what that one's all about. So that's really, it's a silver bullet of sorts in that it gives you such a massive hit of beneficial nutrients for performance that kind of, as long as you've got a good diet at those really high periods, then that's going to look after that. So that one really was all about, it wasn't so much about how much carbs, how much fat, how much protein. It's what is the best nutrient breakdown for before and particularly after a workout. But with the gel, it definitely had to have some carbohydrate in there, because whereas we are doing carbohydrates down, we need them. You know, our brain needs some glucose going in there. Our bodies need some glucose in there. This is, if you go all the way to removing every single carb out of your diet and never ever have one, well, potentially that may not be great for you either, the same way as if you only ever ate a ton of processed carbs. So it was about striking a balance.
Mm. Now, one of my favorite topics when it comes to Brad Kearns, and I knew of you before you knew of me through Julie Fingar that we brought up earlier, because I ran with her and you were a mentor to her, for her.
And Bob Powers was a mentor for both of us also.
Oh, that might have been before. Right. Yeah, Bob Powers. Yeah. Dear friend of mine and yours, the intuitive training and intuitive eating. Mm. Just what do you learn to listen to? That's a series of podcasts, just intuitive training, intuitive rest, that's a good book, Brad. I think last time you were here, I was helping you with finding a new title and a new project. But this one's in being intuitive. How do we become intuitive eaters out there on the event itself? And Warren, let this question ruminate in your mind too, to add to this discussion. What do you think? How do you become an intuitive? What do you listen to?
It's tough right now, man. I'm telling you, I just got back from a conference on the ketogenic diet. It was called KetoCon, first annual.
KetoCon?
Yeah, KetoCon. Yeah, in Austin, Texas.
Did you have to wear a costume?
No costumes.
Super Friends costume.
Comic-Con, KetoCon. But the level of intensity and excitement on these new dietary topics like the primal paleo scene and now the keto, it's frenzied, and there's so much information and there's so much content being thrown at you and everyone having a take. And we live in the age of the guru and the expert and people trying to call attention to themselves on social media and build their platform and build their brand. And it's absolutely mind-boggling because it gets in the way of that simple, sensible, intuitive approach, because we're looking for the shortcut.
Yep.
You at least you admitted it, Scott. You know, you want that. You want that 4-minute podcast.
That's part of my 7-step program.
That's right. You know, we're looking for a quick shortcut answer.
Program actually. Look for the 3.
Yeah. Exactly. Just cut to the chase, man. I'm too busy, and I want to have a quick performance advantage without needing to do any dirty work or patiently transition my diet away from these indulgences that are thrown in our face everywhere we go. So all this stuff clouds our intuitive abilities. And I think also the peer influence and the kind of the competitiveness in the sports scene, maybe not so much so in the ultra scene as it might be like in the triathlon world where you're comparing bicycle parts and how much they cost and you're feeling inferior because the guy next to you has a $14,000 bike and you only spent $8 on yours. And these kind of things get into your head and you start to get insecure and you start to get all these different emotions and the human frailties come out, where if we were just able to sit back and relax and figure out what brought us the most joy and the most pleasure and the most success in that sense, in terms of our training patterns and whether it worked for you to join that Saturday morning running club that was a little too fast every time, and you just kind of went along with it due to whatever, your carpool was driving you there, who knows what, rather than take ownership of your own experience and think, you know what works for me is blank, and I know it doesn't align with the prevailing thought or, what my peers are doing. And same with diet. I think the people that are the most sensitive, they have kind of an advantage because they know that what works for them might not work for somebody else. Maybe they have a celiac or something, and they know that they can't consume any products that contain gluten. And I'm like, congratulations, because that's sitting you on, it's putting you on a healthier path due to these enforced restrictions that otherwise we might be, all of us are somewhere along that scale, with celiac being the worst, but all of us are sensitive to the negative effects of processed carbohydrates. It's just a matter of degree, and you can kind of assess where you are on that spectrum by the amount of excess body fat that you carry despite careful attention to diet and also putting in the hours of training. And it's just that level of sensitivity that we have to acknowledge and do something about if we want to be better. And that means you might have to, take a step outside of the pack, outside of the sheep pack, and advocate for yourself and say, I'm going to try something different because I don't feel quite right and I think I can do better than this.
The experiment of one, in one, watching what happens.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Warren, what about you? Any clues, intuitive nutrition, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you'll be pleased to know that I do actually, I am the only person in the world who possesses the silver bullet on this, and I'm gonna share it with you now.
I need to get my pen out. I'm taking notes.
We're gonna do paid content from here on out. We're stopping the podcast now. Please join us at the website and hit the donate button. Go ahead, Warren.
If you want to find out, just send your credit card number to.
Yeah.
I maybe have to work on a snappier title for this. We call it checking in. So we all know on a long effort, whether that be a run or if there's any triathletes out there, bike ride, whatever, roughly how often we eat what we will consider a unit of nutrition. It's a bar. It's a half a bar. It's a gel or whatever. Let's say that interval is going to be in the 45-minute window. So when that watch comes around to 45 minutes, you don't just open your mouth and mindlessly stuff something in. You take a beat and you check in. You ask one question, am I hungry? And there it is, ladies and gentlemen. There's your silver bullet. Because when you ask that question, at that point, you go, well, yeah, hell, I am hungry, actually. You go, actually, I'm not. Now, you don't want to then screw this up and blow it and then run the next 3 hours with nothing. So another 45 minutes is probably going to be too long. So maybe give it another 10, 55 minutes. Am I hungry? And you repeat this process, 5-minute intervals, 10-minute intervals, 15-minute intervals, whatever it takes until you reach the point where you go, yeah, I'm hungry. Then you eat. And then you reset. Okay, so now we're back to 45 minutes. Now be aware, you might find that half an hour you start feeling hungry. But as you do this, it's a bit laborious to start with. It requires work, okay? So it's the simplest thing in the world. You have your time interval. When you hit it, you ask, am I hungry? If you are, you eat. If you're not, you keep extending that interval by 5, 10, 15-minute chunks until you are. But it takes work because you're going to have to do this in training. think you're going to have to execute on it. You will get to a point where you are now only ever eating to hunger. So it could be, like I mentioned earlier, you could eat 3-4 times in an hour. Every 10 minutes, I might be hungry. And you might get to a point where you are really hungry. Now, don't eat everything all at once, even though you want to. Eat half the amount you think you really want to eat and give it another 10 minutes. And then, am I hungry? Because you might not be. You've probably got enough on already. But if you are, a little bit more. Just saves you overloading it. But as you learn to expand and contract this checking in system, that's it. You are now going to be working to hunger. And you'll also find, in the same way that if you are used to working with heart rate, then you can maybe step away from that and consider, well, how do I feel when my run is conversational? How does it look when I'm now going towards threshold? And you'll notice, you know, your vision tunnels down, all sorts of things happen in the sort of sensory field. And it's the same with food and fueling. You're going to realize there's a lot of signals going on quite a long time before you get to that point of thinking, I'm hungry. It's just when we're brought up on I'm going to say diet. There we go, not necessarily food, but an information diet that leads us towards carbohydrates. When we're brought up on an industry that is based on a history of carbohydrates and has put a lot of information out there, it's very easy to forget our bodies. And this checking in will bring you right back to it. And the best thing is, when you are good at it, and it won't take you more than a couple of months, you've now got the ability to fuel with zero stomach trouble, particularly if you're using good products that you know work with you. And just to allude to something that was mentioned earlier, it doesn't matter if we say this is a good thing to do. It doesn't matter if an elite athlete recommends a product. It doesn't matter if your best mate recommends it. If it doesn't work for you, then it doesn't matter. Try something else. You know, find the things that work for you. So you've got the things that work for you. You've got this checking in strategy. Bingo. Doesn't matter what the weather, doesn't matter how you feel, doesn't matter how long the race. You're now equipped to fuel off a stable platform right the way through. And credit card numbers over here, please, and send the money to my Swiss bank account.
You know, checking in, I think that's why I bring music to a trail race or run, but I never turn it on. I'm too busy checking in. I'm checking in to nutrition, like you talked about. I'm checking into pace. Am I running too fast? I'm checking into hot spots. Am I getting some chafing somewhere? I mean, it's a continuous check-in, check-out, check-in, check-out. I've got a hill coming up in front of me. How am I feeling now? Am I ready for it? I mean, there's a lot of checking in. I've got an aid station coming up. And with this 200-mile thing, am I tired? Do I need to sleep? I mean, there's a lot of checking in that happens to successfully take care of ourselves out there, which might be part of that intuitive running training stuff. Scott?
I just wanted to kind of put a couple things together that are finally coming into my mind and connecting. One is, to Brad's point, that you need to get in shape. You know, from the very beginning you said, get in shape. That's one way that you can avoid gut bombs is get in shape. I think part of that is if you go out in training and you're pushing yourself too fast, again, Brad, to your point, you're going out with that Saturday morning running group and maybe they're going a little bit too fast and your body isn't used to it. And then you're taking in either bad products or whatever. I think that can cause gut bombs. I know when I go out and where I start getting a little bit, my stomach starts turning a little bit south. If I check in, I'll usually find out I'm pushing myself a little bit further than what I should be pushing myself. So I think that if you're taking notes for me, you know, that's one of the things to avoid those stomach bombs is to check your pace. And maybe tone it down a little bit and see if your stomach can come back.
Yeah, there's not too many things that going a little bit easier can't fix.
Or stopping.
Yeah, or stopping.
Heading to the mini-mart and getting some Skittles.
Yeah.
It's actually number 6 on the list of 6 things to avoid stomach trouble. And one of those is pace, because at that threshold and above, then, you know, there are points sometimes when extreme effort is going to make you retch or throw up or cause problems. And sometimes in pursuance of an A race goal or breaking through a plateau, I would say putting yourself into that position where you do maybe throw up once or twice a year through extreme effort is not a problem dependent on your goals. More than that, it's an issue. And you're exactly right, Scott, that, you know, pace can be a key factor. You may just be stretching beyond where you're trying to be right now. But if this is a recurrent theme, then it's time to look at what you're eating, when you're eating it. And like Don said, to check into to everything, you know, it works the same for injury. It works the same for hydration. It works the same for sleep. It works the same for motivation. It's all part of the puzzle. And who's got time to listen to an iPod in the middle of all that?
Hey, get in shape. You said that was a beginning theme. And Scott, you just brought it up. And I wrote it down because I wanted to get back to it. Get what in shape? I know we're talking about cardiovascular, muscle, and all that stuff. But what about getting your digestive system in shape? Is there anything to that? You know, you take a veteran ultra runner and somebody that's new, and there is some adaptation that has taken place metabolically. You know, their body is adapted, their liver, their stomach, their colon, everything has kind of adapted to these, you know, wild stresses that we're putting on it. Can you get your body in shape, your digestive system? Train your gut. Any thoughts on that?
I think maybe improve your gut. I think the idea of training your gut in the popular literature is really a sort of John Wayne style man up and pour down that stuff that's making you throw up, which is a bit like, you know, you go to the doctor with a sore head because you've been banging it on the wall and he tells you to bang it on the wall more. It's not the answer. But in terms of becoming more conscious about what you eat, becoming more conscious about your diet, becoming more conscious about how your foods make you feel, then that takes you to a path where, you know, you are building that platform of health. And part of that is gut health, digestive health. Your body responds more readily to the right foods. You're not putting in the foods that stop it from responding. So by putting yourself into a sport of ultra running where, you know, weaknesses are exposed very quickly. You can't, you know, you can have a stone in your shoe for 10K, but forget it if you're running 100K or even 100 miler. Any weaknesses are very rapidly exposed. And if you want to move on, you have to build the strongest foundation possible. And that's where the consciousness and the great diet comes in. And that, I think, is the kind of gut training I would recommend people really shoot for, because that delivers the long-term results. If you're forcing down products you hate that don't deliver, then you're eating the wrong things and you're doing the wrong things.
So if you get some inflammatory reaction in the gut, Brad, and this is directed towards you because I think this is right in your wheelhouse, that if you get a lot of inflammatory reaction in the gut itself, you really can't expect it to perform well out there. And if you have repaired it, like you're talking about, Warren, with good product going in, you settle it down and it becomes a more efficient organ so that you can use it when needed. So just building a healthy stomach lining and colon, all the things that are not already inflamed, gives you the best bet of getting that gut in shape.
Yeah, I mean, living everyday healthy lifestyle is a big deal, especially when you're out there pushing the limits of your abilities as an athlete. So getting enough sleep, a lot of restoration happens during sleep cycle, especially in the intestinal microbiome. So that's a big one. And then eating the healthy foods and staying away from those toxic foods that endurance athletes, frankly, throw those down in the name of their training or because they feel like they've earned a hall pass. For every 27 miles a week you run, you get one hot fudge sundae and some bagels and lox for the morning. And we think in this mentality of like, how much food can I eat without packing on too much extra weight? And it's a ton because I run so much more than my next door neighbor who eats in a more moderate manner. So that part, just getting the lifestyle things handled so that you're not, a lot of times the intestinal tract is the first thing to go in a general health aspect, especially with athletes. And I remember on the triathlon circuit training with the hardest training guys in the world, no one put in more hours than triathlete because of the three sports. And the gut problems were prevalent because that was the line that was crossed into overtraining. It wasn't a sore knee so much as just a general malaise relating to the digestive tract and problems manifesting. So you got to get that lifestyle stuff handled. And then speaking of getting in shape, there's one other item on the list, and I would say you got to get your head in shape. And a lot of times these things like checking in and seeing if you're hungry, there's some things playing into the story, like psychological frailties and insecurities. So you're out there on the trail, you're a little bit, uptight and stressed about your performance, and you check in and you say, yeah, I'm hungry, I'm going to go slam down some more food. But it's really something that's
anxiety.
Insecurity and anxiety, yeah. And maybe even boredom, especially during the workday when you're walking around, you need a break from cognitive focus on your screen. So you walk into the break room, of course you're hungry because someone brought a pecan pie in. I remember a transition or a breakthrough point for me was training with the fitness legend Johnny G, who created the spinning program, indoor exercise program. And back when I was training with him in Los Angeles, he was training for the Race Across America nonstop. This was the nonstop days, not the relay days. But they started the gun at the Pacific Ocean, and they race nonstop to New York City. And whoever got their first period, there were no mandatory rest periods. This was hardcore.
Ooh, wow.
8 days for the winner, and then on to 9 or 10 days for most finishers. But one day we started out and we got to like mile two of a 100-mile bike ride, and he pulled me over and he says, let me see what kind of food you have today. And I said, oh, sure. I was maybe thinking he wanted to share something.
Yeah.
So I whipped out my peanut butter and banana sandwich. I had a bag of the Twizzler licorice, the mix between black and red. I had, these coconut date balls that I went and drove specially 100 miles out to Palm Springs to pick up these huge stashes of these delicious coconut date balls. And I had all this stuff, and I had it in my hands, and he grabbed them one by one and threw them over a fence into the Los Angeles River. And then he reached into his bike bottle cage and he gave me a bottle of Cali tea, which is non-caloric. It's just the green powder. And he put chlorella powder in there with the mix of Cali tea. And he says, today, my boy, we are riding 100 miles on Cali tea and chlorella powder. And he knew that I was sort of OCD about my fueling needs on a long bike ride, and he wanted me to achieve a breakthrough. He was my trainer and mentor, and so I was forced to pedal my bicycle 100 miles on maybe 42 calories that were in the chlorella powder. Mm. But I was able to do it because I had no choice. And I was in shape, so I was able to push the limits of my metabolic abilities in that manner, and I had some fat adaptation going just because of the hard training and all that. But we finished and we were just fine. And I had that psychological breakthrough of, I'm not going to think about fuel because I'm not going to get any fuel. And I also want to get back to my house so I can have a nice, nutritious lunch when I finish. And that was something that I took with me forevermore, that the fuel is great. It'll help reduce the stress of the workout. It's not recommended at home. Don't try this at home until you have those abilities built up. But it was a breakthrough in that sense.
And we're all a bit fat adapted. Everybody listening to this has some degree of fat adaptation.
We all burn fat and we all burn carbohydrates. It's just that percentage.
Yeah, we have to, because we're out there running in a deficit. If we can only take in 400 calories or 300, whatever the number is that we can digest, we are leaning quite a bit on our body's natural fat adaption already. So whether you're listening to this thinking, well, I've got to get fat adapted, we already are fat adapted to some degree. Now just time to increase.
Mm-hmm.
And can I bring up another topic, and maybe it will be our last topic, or you may just dismiss it.
Edit it out entirely. If you're listening to this now, whatever.
We're talking about gut bombs. How important is hydration when it comes to keeping your stomach in a good place?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Warren, you put it in your article. How important is hydration according to your opinion?
It's key. I mean, if you, let's face it, the stomach is already compromised. It's not getting a full amount of blood flow. It's going to struggle with digestion anyway. So if there's not enough water in the mix, just think of a cement mixer. That stuff's going to be even harder to digest. So you do definitely want to keep on top of the hydration, simply to keep things moving, to keep the body hydrated, to keep the cells hydrated, to keep yourself loose. Without the hydration, that is a key part. If you are regularly suffering stomach trouble, it could simply be you are not drinking enough. By the same token, you can easily drink too much, because if the body's not going to absorb it, it's just going to be sloshing around in your stomach. And that plays back to our earlier threads of listening to your body. So as the most basic rule of thumb, if you're thinking about water, drink some.
What are your experiences, Brad?
Wow, it's getting to be a controversial topic, really, this hydration question. and some leaders in the field, like Stacy Sims out of Stanford, has communicated some really interesting nuances about the hydration aspect, especially for females, because their hydration needs vary so tremendously according to their cycles and things like that. There's also Kelly Starrett. He's a big guy in the CrossFit world, Mobility Wad, and talking about the difference between just indiscriminately slamming water and then taking a preparation that has a little bit of sodium and even a little bit of glucose in it so that it will be absorbed by your tissues better. And so there's this concept of strategic hydration where you hydrate yourself beforehand. Because if you just go according to your thirst mechanism, the thirst mechanism might get muted when you're under stress from a long distance exercise in hot weather, or you might have an accumulative effect where if you keep working out over the summertime in these hot, humid conditions and you feel fine and you finish your 8-mile run and then you go sit at a cube all day and you still feel fine, but you're a little bit dehydrated, then you start digging yourself a hole. There's all these kind of things that come into play that make it more complex than the previous notion that was, hey, don't drink too much water, or you'll be one of those hyponatremic whales that pass out on a marathon and have a bad fate in the emergency room. So it's pretty tricky, and there's no simple answer like, hey, just use your intuition and drink when you feel like it, because you might dig yourself a hole. So it's something that everyone owes a little bit of research and investigating. I know in the old days, some people would do these weigh-in sessions where they'd go for a run, they'd weigh themselves beforehand, especially if they're dealing with hot weather conditions over the summer months, and then they'd weigh themselves after, and the goal is to not lose too much fluid during the run, because that could indicate you're less hydrated than when you start.
Mm-hmm. And you brought up something interesting that I never considered because I'm not female, but during a menstrual cycle of requiring more hydration if you're a female, that's or less? Or
differing levels, yeah. It's not something to do a quick soundbite. Sorry, Scott, we're going to have to do a whole show and maybe get Stacey Sims on here and some of the other people that have really thought about this. Tim Noakes wrote a book called Waterlogged, and that was mainly on the topic of obsessively overhydrating to the extent that you get into a dangerous medical condition known as hyponatremia. And that was kind of the classic team and training novice marathon runner where the coach says, drink, set your watch to beep every 20 minutes and slam water until you're sloshing around and weigh 14 pounds more than when you started the run. Yeah. And so that's a real no-no. But, the rest of it's something that's it's getting more attention paid to it and more research.
Good stuff. Anything else? So as we wrap this thing up, any other comments, burning comments to make, Warren, that you have on your side that you want to share with us? Maybe a last plea of help to try to exit the Studio G basement?
Well, I'm actually working on a flag that I'm going to get out the window shortly. So if you're in the Roseville area and you see an English flag poking out, please come and get me. I'm going to just put one last thing out there, which is breakfast. Okay. Race day breakfast, pre-race breakfast, Ironman breakfast, ultramarathon breakfast, whatever you want to call it, right? There's one word that's the same every time. It's breakfast. Okay. People can get pretty carried away with what to eat, and it's breakfast, right? So if you don't normally eat 4 bowls of pasta for breakfast before you run, don't do that on race day and think it's going to work. It's the exact same thing as going, hey, I think I'll try these new trainers I never wore before this 100-miler. Not going to happen. Just eat your regular breakfast. Eat the things you like. Watch the timing a little bit. Give yourself maybe a 1 hour between breakfast and race start, maybe a little bit more depending on experience. But to cut that one short, breakfast, it's breakfast.
Now, if we want to read more, Scott had mentioned earlier, and Brad did too, your website is packed with information. Where does a person go to learn and expand their knowledge base?
To the show notes. To the show notes, Don.
Of course. Not everyone has access to those, Scott.
Everyone has access to the show notes.
I've never seen them.
I know, because you never read them.
Oh, Warren.
They would want to go to 33shake.com, 33shake.com. And then if you go to the blog on there, you will find all manner of stuff. Just one thing, due to the fun of international e-commerce, I won't bore you with those details. But if you are in America and you're looking at the blog and you're thinking, hey, there's not so much on here, go to the English site, just toggle the button at the top of the website, and you'll get onto the blog on there. It is absolutely loaded with everything, and I am looking forward to getting it sorted out so that we have the same content on both sides in due course. But it's all there at 33shake.com, and you can get lost in there and learn, reach out, ask us questions, anything you like. But really, if you want to go anywhere first, I would definitely go to the Trail Runner Nation show notes. They're a gold standard in the world of show notes.
Oh, yes, yeah, so they are the gold standard. We all strive to hit that. And Brad Kearns over at Primal Endurance Podcast. We have hijacked you, kidnapped you over here to this podcast for a moment, but you can always find great content over there. Right. I subscribe to it. Good yep. stuff. And you have a new book coming up.
Yeah, if you go to primalendurance.fit, that'll be of great interest to the listeners because we just launched this online multimedia mastery course with tons of videos interviewing the world's leading experts on endurance training. And it's a comprehensive program where you enroll and you get all this access to the digital educational items that are framed around the book Primal Endurance. But I had great interviews. I traveled all around North America talking to the great past champions in many sports, Olympic gold medalists, top coaches, researchers. And so we tried to put it all together to really give you a full education on all the aspects of training, especially the diet part and integrating a little bit of this ancestral primal paleo philosophy into your endurance goals rather than being carbohydrate dependent and suffering accordingly.
Good. And I think you have a link to Trail Runner Nation show notes on your website. It's a bit obscure. You gotta really hunt for it, but I think it's there.
So it's primalendurance.fit?
.fit.
I've never
that?
Heard of a .fit.
A .fit is available now. Huh. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Maybe we should change it to trailrunnernation.fit.
Already ahead of you, pal. We've already got it secured.
Do we?
I'm not releasing this thing until we do.
Yeah.
All right. Warren, as always, thank you. If you want us to raise some funds to help you get a haircut, we can do it. It might speak to how long you've been in the TRN basement because your hair is quite long at this point. We apologize.
Is there some wind resistance involved in that? Do you pull it back so you can run fast?
I wish I could run. In this basement, there's no room. I got like 2 meters by 2 meters, and but I'm getting there. When I come out, I maybe will invest in a hair net or something to keep it out of the way. One thing I forgot to mention earlier, yes. of course, is if people are at 33shake.com and they did want to pick something up and they yes. were listening to Trail Runner Nation. There's a code, TRN33, gets you 10% off absolutely all of our nutrition products. So just putting that in there. But a real pleasure to be here. Please do come and rescue me from the cupboard sometime soon. And I will escape. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Very good. So go out and eat.
Mas.